Welcome to Vital Interest. My name is Karen Greenberg, and I am the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School. Our podcast is designed to help you understand security in its many dimensions. Each week, we will bring you thoughtful voices from the worlds of policy, government, law, journalism, and advocacy. We will look at the challenges that confront us today and tomorrow, from pandemic to climate change, from terrorism to population migration, from war to peace, all with an eye towards the rule of law, the protection of human rights, and the respect for civil liberties. Vital Interest Podcast is committed to making the world we live in more comprehensible, the part we play in it more engaged, and our futures more secure. It is our way here at CNS of connecting with our times and with one another.
I think going back to this idea that the Attorney General sets the tone for the Justice Department and what the rule of law means in an administration. So I think it's really important that the Attorney General have a healthy respect for the rule of law, understand what the role that DOJ plays as an institution in terms of applying the law impartially and, you know, without fear or favor, as they say, and really, you know, restoring the confidence of, I think, both the public and the career attorneys at DOJ in the Justice Department's mission. And I really do think that tone starts at the top.
That was Annie Owens. Annie Owens is a senior counsel at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown University Law Center. She served as senior counsel to ranking member Dianne Feinstein for the Senate Judiciary from 2017 to 2019, and as an attorney advisor in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel from 2013 to 2017. And currently, she's been working with the American Constitution Society on a small workshop on reforming the Office of Legal Counsel. Hi, Annie. Welcome to Vital Interest Podcast. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Now, before we get started, I want to talk a little bit about what all those titles you've had are. So first, what do you do as senior counsel for Dianne Feinstein? What's your job?
When I work for Senator Feinstein, I work for her Senate Judiciary Committee staff on a number of different issues, including in particular oversight matters, constitutional law matters, and nominations.
Anybody interesting get nominated during that period of time?
During that period of time, we saw nominations for Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Bill Barr to be the Attorney General, among others.
Wow. So you actually had a significant role in the history of American jurisprudence, I would say.
A little bit.
Okay. And what about OLC? Tell us about the Office of Legal Counsel, what it does, what it means to be a lawyer there. You don't have to give us the entire history, but it was founded within the Solicitor General's office. And I think that tells you both something about its intention and what's changed over time. Can you give us a snapshot history as perhaps one of the best experts on OLC that I know?
Well, thanks for that. Sure. So I served as an attorney advisor in the Office of Legal Counsel from 2013 to 2017. And an attorney advisor is a career line attorney position. And I was one of about 20 to 25 lawyers in the office. It's a fairly small component within the Department of Justice. And OLC's primary role is to advise the White House and executive branch agencies on the legality and constitutionality of their actions. And as you mentioned, it does have a fairly long pedigree. And in fact, you can trace the functions of the Office of Legal Counsel to the Constitution itself and to the Judiciary Act of 1789. The Constitution provides that the president can seek advice from the department heads. And the legal advice function in particular has been assigned to the Attorney General, which in turn has been delegated to the Office of Legal Counsel. Well, initially this role was performed by the Attorney General himself. Then it was done through the Office of the Solicitor General. There was one attorney there who sort of was assigned these advisory functions. And then around the middle of the last century, OLC itself was formed and as an office now performs that function. So OLC really has played a critical role throughout history in helping the president carry out his duties under Article 2 of the Constitution, including in particular taking care that the laws be faithfully executed, which is a critical function, which entails, you know, performing the executive function in compliance with the law.
It sounds to me like it's a very confused mission. You're both working for the president and there to restrain him or her if something seems unlawful in violation of the Constitution. So built into it is sort of a tension. Would that be right?
Yes, there is sort of that inherent tension in the office's mission, which I'm not sure is necessarily a problem. It's just something that the office itself needs to recognize is there and be wary of. I think a lot of people maybe who have not served in the office or who aren't as familiar with the office's responsibilities have this idea that OLC is like the Supreme Court of the executive branch and necessarily has to be purely independent in the way an Article III court is expected to be. And that's just not OLC's role. That's not how it is set up within the executive branch. The executive branch, unlike the judiciary, is a politically accountable, democratically accountable branch. OLC itself is headed by a political appointee and answers directly to the attorney general, who is also a political appointee, who answers to the president. So just in terms of its structure, OLC, by virtue of being in the executive branch, necessarily doesn't have the same independence as a court, and I don't think should be expected to. That is not to say that OLC is incapable or shouldn't be expected to provide, you know, independent, candid, responsible legal advice based on its best view of the law and help the president in good faith carry out his constitutional functions. I mean, just because an entity is not a court doesn't mean that it is not bound to follow the law and shouldn't give its best effort to figure out what the best view of the law is generally. And that is, at its core is OLC's mission.
Right. And that kind of took a little detour under President Bush in some of the War on Terror memos, in particular the ones on torture, but not only the ones on torture, and sort of expanding our understanding of law and constitutional protections. And so is that why OLC is under scrutiny now, because of what began under the Bush administration and, as we've seen under the Trump administration, has proved an enabling role, maybe in a way that needs to be rethought?
I think so, in terms of sort of the root of the scrutiny of OLC. And to be clear, I think OLC generally faces some criticism from people on the outside suggesting that OLC is too pro-executive in its approach. This sort of ties back to what I was just saying about OLC's role within the executive branch. I'm not sure that a concern for executive branch prerogatives standing alone is necessarily a problem. I think if each branch aggressively stood up for its own prerogatives and interests against the other, we would have more of this push and pull under the checks and balances of the Constitution that Madison and the other founders envisioned. So that standing alone is not necessarily a problem. It's when OLC stretches the law beyond its bounds or is not sort of approaching problems with an eye toward figuring out what the best view of the law is, and instead is attempting to facilitate the president's political interests or reach a predetermined outcome, that's when the office runs into problems. And I think we certainly saw that during the Bush administration. I'm sure your listeners are well aware of what happened with the torture memos, and that was certainly a dark stain on in OLC's history. And the root of that, really, I do think was, you know, this sort of outcome determinative lawyering and not really being faithful to OLC's core mission. I think in some respects, and you know, again, this is sort of speculation sitting on the outside, seeing some of the things that have come out of the office during this current administration, I think there are a lot of legitimate concerns that in some respects the office has sort of slid back into that type of lawyering and has strayed a little bit from its core mission. And that includes, you know, taking this sort of concern for executive branch prerogatives to an extreme in a way where we're no longer talking about normal balancing under separation of powers doctrine, or, you know, considering all sides of the issue, but coming down in a way that protects the executive branch's interests, but instead stretches the law and really tries to reach the president's desired outcome.
Right. So with the American Constitution Society, you've worked on this small workshop we referred to and issued a series of recommendations in a document called The OLC and the Rule of Law. And in it, there are several recommendations that are attempt to, depending on your language, revitalize, reform, rethink in some ways, but I would say restore some of this original purpose and mission of OLC. Do you want to just summarize the takeaways, the recommendations that the committee made?
Sure. In this document.
And just before we get there, maybe tell our listeners a little bit about the American Constitution Society.
Sure. The American Constitution Society is a nonprofit legal organization headed now by Russ Feingold, which is just really sort of a legal progressive organization that considers various issues of law, issue briefs, host discussions.
Yeah, and they've been very active lately. I've been noticed they've been putting out a lot of just interesting thought pieces about what's going on. There's certainly a lot to think about. So tell us a little bit about this Rule of Law and OLC, or OLC and the Rule of Law report, and what its recommendations were.
Sure. This report came out of sort of a two-day small workshop that ACS hosted, which was attended by various alumni of OLC and law professors, legal experts, other people who have written about OLC or executive power. And it was a really interesting sort of two-day conversation about the office, the role of the office, what it's done in the past, how it's been comporting itself under the current administration, and what steps might be taken to revitalize the office's role in the future. And this OLC and the Rule of Law document is really sort of a summary of what of the conclusions that the group reached about certain actions that can be taken to revitalize the office and really restore it to its proper role, which again is, you know, giving candid, responsible, independent legal advice based on its best view of the law.
And those recommendations are?
So those recommendations include several things. I think first is sort of a retrospective review of the opinions that have come out of the office in the last few years, particularly with respect to separation of powers. And,
you know, I think one of the most frustrating things about Office of Legal Counsel, and you've referred to this in several of your writings, is the, you know, lack of transparency, which is that it's so hard to talk about this office when we don't know exactly what's there. And there are a lot of things that have happened under this administration in particular, where you really have to ask yourself, I wonder if there was an OLC memo about that particular thing. And some of them we've seen referred to, but we just don't know. So in terms of talking about how to do a retrospective on memos, I have a question for you. When you come into OLC as a new member of a team, let's say under a new president, are you automatically given access to all former OLC memos?
Yes, OLC maintains a database that includes its own memos as well as emails and informal advice that they
Okay. So the body of work does exist. You're sure about that?
Yes.
I know that President Obama came in and talked at the outset of his presidency about the need for transparency in a variety of areas. But it's hard because when you're dealing with national security, there are certain things that just can't be published. But is there a way of coming up with a best practices on what could be published and what not published so that an administration can't readily hide behind it and say, you know what, we're not going to publish this. And the bar could be, you know, very, very low for establishing secrecy. So how does this report speak to that?
Sure. So this really is sort of the evergreen question with OLC, access to the office's work. And I'm of two minds of this because I agree that transparency is important. and particularly having now served in the Senate Judiciary Committee, you know, I've seen
right, you've seen both sides.
It's really hard to do oversight over an office that, you know, where you can't really see or understand what it's doing. So I am very sympathetic to these arguments that OLC needs to be as transparent as possible. And in fact, one of the recommendations in this ACS rule of law document is that OLC establish a real presumption in favor of publishing final opinions. And I think that's right. Obviously, there are going to be times when the office can't publish its opinions. For instance, if they contain classified information or otherwise deal with sensitive topics. So I do think that there needs to be sort of a case-by-case consideration of each to determine whether they are proper candidates for publication. But by and large, when you're talking about a final memo that contains, you know, final advice, it seems like the presumption should be in favor of publication. And this gets a little complicated because OLC itself just can't make the determination that a certain opinion can be published because it contains legal advice that OLC has given to a different agency or the White House. So OLC always needs to get the consent of the client agency or the White House before it can publish. But I do think that whether it's through an executive order or presidential memorandum or somehow setting the tone, the president can establish a presumption of publication that I think and encourage client agencies to adhere to that. So I think there are ways to enhance OLC transparency and get more of this material out in the public.
You know, if you're lawyers at OLC and you write memos and the head of OLC reviews it, I'm assuming that's part of the process, then where does it go? Does it go to the Deputy Attorney General? Does it go to the Attorney General? What's the actual course of a memo's approval in the best practices scenario?
Since the Bush administration, since the torture memos, OLC has issued at least two public best practices memos that sort of lay out this process.
Yes.
So when an agency comes to OLC for formal advice, and by formal advice, I mean advice that will be memorialized in a formal opinion that may or may not be published, the agency generally submits this request to OLC in writing, and then OLC considers it. The office will request the views of the affected agency. So it might be in addition to the agency that has requested the advice, if another agency has equities in the issue, or if this is a dispute between two agencies, sometimes that happens over, you know, the proper interpretation of a statute or their jurisdiction or whatever, OLC will solicit the views of all the affected agencies. So you essentially have a set of writings, almost like legal briefs from the affected agencies that OLC reviews. And then generally, an attorney advisor like I was will get started on, you know, researching and writing the first draft of the memo. And once the draft is ready, it will be transmitted to the deputy who has been assigned to the matter. The deputy reviews that. And I think this is a really sort of key protection that, as far as I know, was instituted after the torture memos became public. OLC has what it calls a two-deputy review rule. So anything that is signed by the office needs to be reviewed by two deputies to ensure that it's correct and based on the best view of the law, et cetera. So you sort of have this internal process where it goes from attorney advisor to deputy one to deputy two. Then it'll go to the head of the office for final review and sign off. And a lot of times that is sort of where it ends. So after the head of the office, the assistant attorney general signs off on it, then the formal opinion gets transmitted to the requesting agency. And by tradition in the executive branch, OLC advice is treated as binding. There's no statute that requires that, but generally, once OLC has spoken on an issue, that is the final word on the matter.
Does that make it law?
So
I like that word binding. I'm just like, how far does that, I mean, I know this has been recently litigated actually, but just how should our listeners think about that?
So that is a good question. And I think one of the ongoing debates about the nature of OLC opinions. Personally, I don't think that gives OLC opinions the force of law. It just makes them binding by tradition in the executive branch. There's no statute that requires this. There really aren't a lot of formal consequences for not following OLC advice. Although I will say, by virtue of OLC's role within DOJ and within the executive branch, the Attorney General has the final word on whether to accept OLC's advice, as does the president. So both the Attorney General and the president can essentially overturn an OLC opinion if they think it's merited. Now, that doesn't happen very often at all.
So OLC can choose to decide what's going to be made public or what's not going to be made public of the opinions. Like if you go on the OLC website, you'll see certain memos put forward there. And then the question becomes, what if somebody wanted to challenge it, a public opinion? Not the ones that we don't know about, but wanted to challenge it. Is there a way to legally challenge something like that?
So I will just correct one thing that you said.
Please.
OLC can determine what gets published with the consent of the requesting agency. So it's never a unilateral decision by OLC to give legal advice. In terms of, there's no formal mechanism to challenge an OLC opinion. I do think that if OLC opines on something and then it becomes the litigating position of DOJ in a lawsuit, that is sort of how OLC's conclusions get challenged. But a lot of times, you know, OLC will opine on issues that are not justiciable and they really can't be heard by a court. And that's really an important role that OLC plays in helping the president conform his conduct to the law and the Constitution, is opining on these issues where there just isn't any guidance anywhere.
I want to read from the statement that was issued by the American Constitution Society, because it gets to the larger issue of the Department of Justice. So I just thought I would read a part of it. Over the past 4 years, its credibility, Department of Justice's credibility and integrity, have eroded to the point of crisis. In particular, actions of the department's leadership have cast doubt on its independence from the partisan and personal interests of the president. In its refusal to collaborate with Congress on oversight matters, the department has retreated into a defensive, isolationist crouch. So that is something that's bigger than OLC, right? OLC may be a symptom of this. But in terms of the fixing of the Department of Justice, is it really much more than the Office of Legal Counsel, or will fixing the Office of Legal Counsel in effect represent a rather important transformation of the department writ large?
Well, I do think that this is certainly a bigger issue than just the Office of Legal Counsel, and that really restoring DOJ's credibility is going to take a multi-pronged approach. But I do think that starts with the Attorney General. And one of the issues that I have observed over the past few years is that we really do have an Attorney General at the top. I'm talking about Bill Barr, who just announced that he's planning to resign. But we've had an Attorney General at the top setting a tone.
We should also say that William Barr was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel early in his career.
That's right. So I do think Bill Barr really has set a tone from the top. One, that it is okay for the Justice Department to intervene to help the president politically and personally, which is not really something we've seen from the Justice Department before, and is something that I know career DOJ people really recoil at, because that just strikes right at the heart of DOJ's integrity and is so counter to its mission. And not only that, but Bill Barr, who, as you mentioned, was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel during the first Bush administration, has long held extremely aggressive and I think out of the mainstream views on separation of power doctrine, and in particular views the separation of powers as a doctrine that exalts the presidency over Congress and its co-equal branches. And I think some of that came across in some of Barr's writings from 1989, 1990, when he was in the Office of Legal Counsel. So he sort of wrote a memo on separation of powers while he was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel called Common Legislative Encroachments on Executive Branch Authority, that really took this aggressive approach to separation of powers and treated many routine instances of congressional exercise of authority as encroachments on the executive branch, which in my mind is really contrary to a proper conception of separation of powers as recognized by the Supreme Court and as recognized by the Office of Legal Counsel and other administrations, that really when you have clashing prerogatives between two branches, the correct approach is to balance the interests of the branches and sort of come to an outcome that respects the interests of each. But this memo that Barr wrote really sort of turns that on its head and turns everything into an attack on the executive branch. Now, that memo was superseded in 1996 by another Office of Legal Counsel memo.
So this was by Walter Dellinger?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So this 1996 memo, which was issued when Walter Dellinger was the head of OLC and is referred to colloquially as the Dellinger memo, superseded this previous Barr memo that I just described and took a more balanced approach to the separation powers, recognizing that normally this sort of balancing test does apply. I will say, you know, you can still see in the Dellinger memo a desire to protect executive branch prerogatives. And as I mentioned before, I think that's perfectly appropriate coming from an office that is situated within the executive branch and dealing with these sorts of issues. But it also recognizes that Congress has various institutional interests of its own, including in sometimes access to executive branch information and other things like that. So it really does take a more balanced approach in line with how the Supreme Court has approached these issues. And that is the guidance that has really guided now generations of OLC attorneys, including when I was in the office, and sets forth the proper approach to these issues. One of the recommendations in this OLC and the Rule of Law document from ACS is that that memo be updated because it was written in 1996 and a lot of the case law has developed since then. And it would also just be valuable to the office to reaffirm an approach to the separation of powers that takes into account the interests of the co-equal branches. And also, you know, updates it with the development since 1996 that the attorneys in the office can turn to as a reference.
You know, it's really interesting that it hasn't been updated since then, given what's gone on in between. And you would think that one of the things that needs to be updated is a direct discussion of commander-in-chief powers. I mean, given what happened in John Yoo's time under the Bush administration, it seems to me that it was just an extra layer of how to think about presidential powers. Does that make sense or do you think not?
I think that's right. And I do think that's one area where it would be valuable for the office to clarify what the limits of those powers are. You know, it is not as if the office has not opined on this since 1996. But I agree with you, the commander-in-chief power is one example. And I'm also thinking of recent Supreme Court opinions involving the appointments and removal powers and issues like that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, just a couple of things that are coming down the pike in terms of the transition to the new presidency, the Biden presidency, is, well, as you say, that Attorney General Barr resigned last night, but President-elect Biden has not named his attorney general. But just any thoughts about what you think is most important about a new AG?
I think going back to this idea that the attorney general sets the tone for the Justice Department and what the rule of law means in an administration. So I think it's really important that the attorney general have a healthy respect for the rule of law, understand what the role that DOJ plays as an institution in terms of applying the law impartially and, you know, without fear or favor, as they say, and really, you know, restoring the confidence of, I think, both the public and the career attorneys at DOJ in the Justice Department's mission. And I really do think that tone starts at the top. And I do think, as we've seen from this past administration, who you pick matters, but also who the president is matters. And I have, you know, every confidence that whoever the president-elect picks is going to have a healthy respect for all of these things.
So in a way, but what you're saying is, and I think this is what we've learned outside of the Department of Justice and inside the Department of Justice, is kind of what you just said. Yes, it's great to have best practices. It's great to have well-intentioned and educated lawyers. It's great to have a leadership from the president in ways that respect the rule of law. It comes down to the person who's president. Is that basically what we're saying?
I think that's right. And the Justice Department, and OLC in particular, I think, is a place that really runs on norms and traditions. And a lot of these things you can't really codify. You can't just pass a statute for a lot of reasons, but I also think for separation of powers reasons. And Congress can't pass a statute governing how the president solicits and receives legal advice. And so, you know, these norms that OLC has really worked to build up over decades become really important. And they are tested when you have people in power who don't necessarily respect norms and traditions. And I think we have seen an example of that during this past administration, unfortunately.
That kind of brings us to our last question, which is always the same, which is, in your view, thinking about these particular issues, what gives you hope?
Well, I will say a few things. First of all, the Office of Legal Counsel is staffed by a fantastic group of career attorneys, many of whom have been there for years and years and years. They respect the rule of law, they're brilliant. They really do play a vital role in carrying on these norms and traditions and make the office what it is. And whenever I begin to question what the leadership is doing, I take a lot of comfort in knowing that those career attorneys are there and carrying on the best parts of the Office of Legal Counsel, and that it's still there. And I think in this upcoming administration, I have a lot of faith that the head of the Office of Legal Counsel and the Attorney General are going to be people who respect the best traditions of the Department of Justice and OLC, and will really return both institutions to where they're supposed to be. And I think will do a lot of work toward depoliticizing the office and the Department of Justice and restoring public confidence in them both.
A good note on which to end. Annie Owens, thank you so much. For our listeners, if you'd like to read more, and we'll provide the links, look at the report by the American Constitution Society on the OLC and the rule of law. And Annie Owens has a piece coming out in the Yale Law Journal Forum, an online forum, on the Office of Legal Counsel and the issue of separation of powers in particular. And it's a volume in honor of the DOJ's 150th anniversary, which is a whole nother podcast. Annie Owens, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. We hope it made your day a little brighter, a little clearer, and a little more informed. Join us next time for the newest installment of Vital Interest Podcast. In the meantime, feel free to send us your questions at vitalinterestpodcast.org and to follow us on Twitter at @VI_podcastCNS. And make sure to check out our daily morning brief, our weekly cyber brief, and our Vital Interest online forum at CenterOnNationalSecurity.org. Have a wonderful week, and please stay safe.